The works of Hesiod, Theogony, Works and Days, The Shield of Heracles, by Hesiod, narrated by Darren Grimes.
Introduction. Hesiod is a less familiar name to the general reader than Homer, Aeschylus, or Plato. And no one would claim that he is as great a writer as they. He was, nevertheless, one of the most famous poets of antiquity, often mentioned in the same breath as Homer, as the other main representative of the early world view. His distinctive qualities were admired by some of the most sophisticated poets of the Alexandrian age, one of the most sophisticated of ages. And in general, his influence on Greek and Roman literature, while not comparable with Homer's, was considerable. From the modern point of view, he is fascinating for his mythology, some of which can now be traced back to Babylonian origins, for his religious outlook, in which constructive abstract reasoning coexists with traditional doctrine, quaint superstition, and prophetic fervor. And above all, for the unique light he throws on the life and society of the archaic Greece in which he lived. We have no exact dates for him, but we shall not be far wrong if we place his poetic activity in the last third of the 8th century BC. The 8th century was for most of Greece a time of growing prosperity, expanding population, and increasing mobility. Some of the maritime Citae were becoming active in trade and colonization, sending their ships far to the west, to Sicily, and up the western coast of Italy, and to the east to Syria and perhaps occasionally Egypt. Contacts with the civilizations of the Orient had been growing slowly since about 900 BC, and after about 770, they grew more rapidly. It is becoming increasingly apparent, with the advance of archaeological discovery and the study of Oriental texts in the cuneiform, that Greece received more far-reaching cultural impulses from the East at this period than anyone imagined 50 years ago. One fact that has always been clear and uncontroversial is the Greeks' borrowing of the alphabet from the Phoenicians and their adaptation of it to their own language. So far as can be judged, this took place about or a little before the middle of the 8th century, following many generations of life without writing. Hesiod and Homer still composed in the limpid formulaic style developed by oral poets over the preceding centuries. And we may assume that they still composed primarily with audiences in view, not readers. But the existence of writing now made it possible for poems to be recorded and preserved in a more or less fixed form. Hesiod and Homer were among the first who took advantage of this possibility, and that is why, from our point of view, they stand at the beginning of Greek literature. The tradition of the heroic epic, as represented by the Homeric poems, had been evolving since the High Mycenaean Age, well back in the 2nd millennium BC. By the 8th century, Ionian poets, perhaps especially in Euboea and other islands of the central Aegean, had brought it to something approaching its final form. One consequence of the increase in communications between different parts of Greece was that this poetry spread everywhere, arousing not only general admiration, but also a new interest in the heroic past. We can see the reflection of this in Hesiod, in his passing allusions to heroic legend, especially the legend of the Trojan War, and the various legends centered on Argos and Thebes. He may not have known the Iliad and Odyssey that we know, my own belief is that they were composed later than his poems, but he was certainly familiar with the epic poetry about Troy and other subjects. In fact, his poems are composed in the same hexameter meter, Ionian dialect, and formulaic diction as those of the Homeric tradition. Though he was not an Ionian himself, he must have chosen this style as being the most fitting or fashionable for the large-scale poems he wished to compose. Unlike Homer, he tells us a certain amount about himself and his life. Hence, we're able to say that his father came from the alien city of Syme on the coast of Asia Minor, just south of Lesbos. Certain occasional traces of alien dialect in Hesiod's work are no doubt to be explained by this. He had been a merchant seaman, but found it difficult to make ends meet and removed to Askra, an out-of-the-way village on the eastern side of Mount Helicon in Boeotia, presumably to make a living off the land. Here, it seems, Hesiod was born and brought up, together with his brother Perseus. He became a poet, so he claims, through instruction from the muses themselves as he tended his lambs, or his father's lambs, on the mountain slopes. The goddesses presented him with a staff as a token of his new role and told him to sing of the family of immortals. The passage served as a model for a series of later poets who boasted playfully of similar encounters with the muses or Apollo. It is debatable to what extent Hesiod himself was following a convention and whether he genuinely experienced a religious vision. It might well be true that it was when he was alone on the mountainside that he realized he had the ability to compose poetry. But he must have listened to many other poets reciting, and they must count as his real instructors. The Theogony fulfills the muses' initial command. Its subject is the origin and genealogies of the gods, and the events that led to the establishment of Zeus as their king. Hesiod had no doubt heard other poems of similar scope, but he probably added to whatever he took over from his predecessors. For example, it looks as if he has invented the list of names which he gives to the nine muses, because the names all seem to be suggested by things that he has been saying about the muses in the preceding passage. The long lists of Nereid and Oceanid nymphs may also owe much to his invention. Altogether, his catalog of gods contains some 300 names. They fall into diverse categories. Some are gods who were actually worshipped, who had altars and priests assigned to them, or at least received prayers or ritual acts of observance at appropriate times. But there are many who, so far as we know, had no cult whatever. Some of them have a role to play in myth, like Atlas, who holds up the sky. Others do not, and are mere names to us. A few of these look like inventions to hold the genealogy together, as their names are transparent, like Asterus is the father of the stars. Then there are components of the physical universe: heaven, earth, sea, the mountains, the rivers, the sun and moon. All these are treated as gods and put in a genealogical relationship with the rest. Genealogy thus takes the place of cosmogony, Hesiod's only answer to the question of how the heaven and earth were created, is to say that first came the chasm, and then earth, and earth gave birth to heaven, and the mountains, and sea. Finally, Hesiod's gods include personified abstractions: death, sleep, deceit, strife, victory, etc. It comes very naturally to Greek poets to speak about abstractions in personified terms, and sometimes to create graphic little scenes in which they are described moving about and acting in human form. When they are personified, they must clearly be classed as gods, not mortals. After all, they are invisible and imperishable, and they have the power to affect human affairs. In their case, the genealogical framework can be used to express perceived affinities, as at 226-32. Hateful strife bore painful toil, neglect, starvation, and tearful pain, battles, combats. Here we see Hesiod systematizing things constructively. In two passages in the later poem, Works and Days, we find him creating new goddesses of this category as a result of further reflection. Near the beginning, he announces his realization that there is another sort of strife, a good sort, and he assigns her a place in his system as the elder sister of the bad one. Towards the end, 760-4, after warning of the dangerous power of rumor, he remarks that once it gets going, it never dies, and this leads him to the thought, she too is somehow a goddess. Interlaced with the genealogies of the Theogony are the successive episodes of what has come to be known as the succession myth, the tale of the succession of divine rulers. It relates how heaven was overcome by Cronos, the leader of the Titans, and how the Titans in turn were overcome by the younger gods led by Zeus. It is a story of crude and bizarre acts of violence, of gods castrating, swallowing, and generally clobbering each other in a way that sophisticated readers of Plato's time found strange and unacceptable. We now know that it was not the product of Hesiod's savage fancy, but a Hellenized version of an Oriental myth, other versions of which are represented in a Hitti text of the 13th century BC and a Babylonian poem of the 11th, sometimes called the Epic of Creation. We cannot say where or how it was first taken over by Greeks, but it seems to have made its way to Hesiod via Crete, where Zeus's birth is placed, and Delphi, where the stone that Cronos swallowed instead of Zeus was exhibited. Another narrative interlude is provided by the story of Prometheus. This is a myth designed to explain the origins of certain institutions and features of the world as we know it. The practice of eating the meat of the sacrificed animal and dedicating the inedible parts to the gods is explained as the consequence of a trick which Prometheus once played on Zeus. Hesiod's piety will not allow that Zeus was really deceived, but the story presupposes that he was. Zeus then tried to withhold fire from men so that they could not cook their meat, but Prometheus stole it and delivered it to them. That is how we acquired that unearthly commodity. Finally, Zeus decided to contrive a punishment for mankind from which there would be no escape. And so we have women. The main part of the Theogony is prefaced by a hymn to the Muses, 1 to 104. It was the regular practice for the reciter of the epic to begin with a hymn to a deity before passing to his main theme. Towards the end of this hymn, Hesiod eulogizes kings and goes on to speak of the power of the poet to make people forget the grief of a recent bereavement. It is possible that this was written for a particular occasion on which it was relevant. In Works and Days, 650 to 660, the poet recalls that once he traveled to Chalcis in Euboea for the funeral games in honor of King Amphimedamus, organized by the king's sons, and that he performed a poem there and won a handsome prize for it. It is tempting to conjecture that the poem was Theogony, or a version of the Theogony. That would certainly account for the lines in the hymn to the Muses, and it may be added that the classes of people to whom he especially recommends the goddess Hecate in 430 to 442, kings, warriors, including cavalry, competing athletes, sea fishermen, must all have been represented in that audience at Chalcis. The Works and Days is a poem of rather varied content. Its peculiar title refers to two sections of the text containing instruction on agricultural tasks and on days of the month that are favorable or unfavorable for different purposes. But these two portions together make up less than half of the whole. An apter title might be The Wisdom of Hesiod. Overall, it can be summed up as a gallimaufry of advice for living a life of honest industry. Although clearly intended for a wide audience, the advice is ostensibly addressed to certain individuals whose honesty and/or industry leave much to be desired. To Hesiod's brother Perseus, who is said to have taken more than his share of their father's estate, but also in other contexts, to have been reduced to beggary by his idleness, and to some kings or local nobles, who are said to have accepted bribes from Perseus and shown him undue favor in return. In the first third of the poem, Perseus and the kings are addressed by turns. Both parties are exhorted to live righteously, and Perseus is also admonished not to live in idleness, but to work for his bread. To explain why work is man's lot, Hesiod retells in a modified form the story of Prometheus and the god's creation of the first woman. In this version, the woman is identified by name as Pandora. And instead of simply being mankind's punishment in her own person as the ancestress of all mortal women, she here releases all ills into the world by opening a jar in which they had been confined. Hesiod has in mind the typical Greek storage jar, a clay vessel a meter or more high, It was a confusion by Erasmus that made it into Pandora's box. This leads on to another famous myth, that of the successive ages, or more correctly, races of mankind, starting from the golden and ending with the iron. Every reference to a golden age in Western literature and speech derives directly or indirectly from this passage of Hesiod. Immediately afterwards, we meet the first animal fable in Western literature, a century before the legendary Aesop is supposed to have lived. In the remaining two-thirds of the poem, the kings fade out of sight, Perseus is still addressed, but it is now assumed that he accepts the need to work and requires practical instruction on how to set about it. In the Works section, 381 to 617, Hesiod goes through the agricultural year from plowing time to plowing time. His main concern is with cereal culture, but he also takes in vine growing. The emphasis is on when to begin each task and on being sure to make all the necessary preparations in good time. We are not actually told much about how to do the jobs. Hesiod is writing a poem, not a technical manual. The contrasted descriptive passages about midwinter and high summer, 507 to 535 and 582 to 596, are purely ornamental, and there are many other memorable picturesque details. The agricultural section is followed by one on seafaring, as the farmer may wish to sell his produce elsewhere. Again, the emphasis is on times and seasons. Hesiod has little to teach us otherwise beyond a few simple mottos. Indeed, he admits to having minimal experience of sailing. Even so, he claims to be able to give instruction, because the muses have taught me to make a song without limit. 662. This may imply that he was drawing on an existing poetic tradition on the subject, as he no doubt was in the case of agriculture. The sailing section is succeeded by some rather miscellaneous advice on conduct towards the gods and in various social contexts. It is here, above all, that we encounter the grandmotherly deposits of Hesiod's mind, taboos and superstitions of everyday life which must have been widely respected, at least in certain levels of society, but which pass unnoticed in other literary sources. Then comes the almanac of days of the month, which again stands quite alone in early Greek literature. Originally, it was followed by a further section on the interpretation of bird omens, but this was condemned as spurious, perhaps unjustifiably, by at least one Alexandrian scholar and has not come down to us. It must be conceded that the Works and Days is a disorderly, often rambling text. It looks as if Hesiod several times extended its scope and added new sections, coming to conceive of the poem as a general compendium of useful advice. Although it appears at first to be composed for one specific situation, the poet's dispute with his brother, a careful study leads to the conclusion that this mise-en-scene is a literary device. Perseus' circumstances shift between one context and another, according to the needs of the context. The kings disappear once, Hesiod is finished with the theme of justice. Perseus becomes more and more colorless, and he too disappears after the section on navigation. The fact is that the poem contains advice for people in many different circumstances and cannot be explained from any single personal situation in which Hesiod found himself. Did Perseus and the quarrel even exist? We cannot prove it. But the likelihood is that they did, and that Hesiod took his dispute with his brother and the local rulers as the starting point for a poem which then took on a life of its own. Whatever impulse personal circumstances may have given to the composition of the Works and Days, it is highly probable that Hesiod knew an established tradition of moral didactic poetry, and moreover, a tradition formed under the influence of Oriental culture. For the closest parallels to his poem are to be found in the Sumerian, Babylonian, Hebrew, and Egyptian traditions of wisdom literature, whose existence can be traced continuously from about 2500 BC to the early centuries of our era. It is a feature of some of the Oriental texts that the instructions they contain comes from a victim of injustice and is combined with reproof and remonstrance. The addressee is someone in need of correction, not merely guidance. Hesiod's poem fits this pattern. His use of an animal fable also points to Oriental antecedents. Although he is the first extant Greek author to show knowledge of such fables, they had a long history in the Near East, starting with the Sumerians in the 3rd millennium. It was certainly from the Levant that they came to Greece. The myth of ages, too, appears to have come from that direction. It seems quite alien to the general Greek idea of the past as reflected in epic and mythological tradition, the inclusion of the race of epic heroes as the fourth in the series disrupts the scheme of metals and of progressive deterioration, and it is obviously a compromise with Greek tradition. The motifs of successive world ages, shortening of man's life, decline from paradise conditions and from perfect virtue, and metallic symbolism can all be paralleled from Oriental texts, Mesopotamian, Jewish, Persian, and Indian. Some of them are later than Hesiod, it is true, but there can hardly be any question of his having influenced them. Finally, the calendar of good and bad days, unique as it is in early Greece, represents a type of superstition attested in Mesopotamia and Egypt. All this is very remarkable, and classical scholars have not yet fully adjusted to it. It is surprising, as we were not brought up to expect it, to find so much reflection of Oriental literature, mythology, and culture in a Greek poet, and especially in one who lived in an upland village in central Greece, miles from the sea. But as I have said, it was a time when Greece was open to Eastern influences of many kinds. Whatever the channels by which they came, it seems that Hesiod was peculiarly well placed to pick them up. His style and diction are essentially those of all Ionian hexameter poetry, including Homeric epic. He writes more tersely than Homer, but with the same reliance on repeated formulae and on ornamental adjectives and adverbs. Zeus will frequently appear as Zeus the resourceful, or Zeus who bears the aegis, or loud thundering Zeus, irrespective of context. The earth will be the dark earth, or the wide pastured earth, or earth the mother of all flocks. All is lucid and straightforward, or almost all. Just occasionally, Hesiod will come out with some elevated oracular phrase like, "Those who till the surly gray, sea fishermen, horned and hornless forest couchers, animals of the woods, do not from the five-branched cut the sear from the green, cut your nails." Whether or not this tendency reflects the influence of oracular poetry as composed at Delphi, as some have conjectured, it adds to Hesiod's individual charm. A number of riddling expressions that he uses for animals, like the boneless one for the octopus, the knowing one for the ant, carry house for the snail, may belong to the same category, though they could not be taken as simply colorful elements of the popular language. In the Works and Days, Hesiod includes many of what look like pre-existing proverbs and popular sayings. Sometimes they stand out as not entirely apt for the context in which he has put them. In places they come thick and fast, one following another into his mind by association. See, for example, the passage beginning, "Seek no evil gains," at 352. A feature more characteristic of the Theogony is the tendency to give etymological explanations of names. At 195 through 200, for instance, Hesiod tells us why Aphrodite is called Aphrodite, Cytherea, Cypress-born, and genial, and shortly afterwards he gives us two reasons why heaven gave his children the collective name of Titans. From the standpoint of a modern philologist, some of the explanations are as preposterous as others are self-evident. But we must understand that Hesiod was not trying to do what a modern philologist does. He had no conception of the evolution of language. He was just aware that there is usually meaning in names, and that sometimes they seem mysteriously to express something of the nature or history of the person or thing named. His etymologies are intended to draw attention to these apparently significant relationships between name and object. One characteristic that unites the two poems is Hesiod's religious attachment to Zeus as the great master of the world and overseer of justice. Zeus overcomes his elders and rivals in the Theogony by sheer physical force. But there is no doubt in Hesiod's mind that this was entirely good and right, and that Zeus has organized his universe justly and wisely. In the Works and Days, Zeus is the subject of the opening hymn, which, brief though it is, sets the keynote for what follows. For easily he makes strong, and easily he oppresses the strong. Easily he diminishes the conspicuous one and magnifies the inconspicuous. And easily he makes the crooked straight and withers the proud. Right is the daughter of Zeus, the rule Zeus has laid down for mankind. He listens to her reports of injustice, rewards the righteous with prosperity, and punishes the unrighteous. Hesiod sometimes feels that the injustice is vanquishing justice, yet he has faith in his God. I do not expect resourceful Zeus is bringing this to pass yet. The wicked will get their deserts, if not spectacularly in their lifetime, then in the gradual decline of their houses, or they may bring disaster on their whole community. Hesiod's tone in such passages has reminded many readers of the Hebrew prophets. We cannot tell how widely Hesiod's poems were during his lifetime, but they certainly seem to have been famous within a couple generations of his death. One consequence of this was that various other genealogical and didactic poems came to be attributed to him, whether by deliberate fraud or simply because he seemed the most appropriate author for anonymous works in these categories. They have mostly perished, except for occasional fragments. One that has survived is The Shield of Heracles, a rather inferior narrative poem which can be dated to the 6th century. We also possess extensive fragments of The Catalogue of Women, likewise of the 6th century. This was a continuation of Theogony in 5 books, 3,000 to 4,000 lines, dealing with the genealogies of the heroes. The women of the title were those with whom the gods chose to have intercourse and from whom heroic families consequently descended. As Hesiod's name attracted genealogical and didactic poems, Homer's attracted heroic epics, at least 9 besides the Iliad and Odyssey. Thus, by the 5th century BC, if not earlier, Hesiod and Homer had come to stand by a sort of shorthand for the whole body of archaic hexameter poetry. The philosopher-poet Xenophanes of Colophon, wishing to criticize the conventional poetic picture of the gods, wrote Homer and Hesiod have attributed to the gods everything that is held discreditable among men, thieving, adultery, deceiving one another. He seems to imply that Homer and Hesiod, as the oldest known poets, were personally responsible for creating this picture. Later in the 5th century, the historian Herodotus says outright, it was these who constructed a divine genealogy for the Greeks and who gave the gods their titles, allocated their powers and privileges to them, and indicated their forms. In the early 4th century BC, a sophist called Alcadamas composed an entertaining fiction about the poetry competition at Chalcis that Hesiod boasts to having won. Alcadamas made Homer take part in the same event, the contest being between the two of them. At first, it seemed that Homer would win. Hesiod set him a series of questions and puzzles, all of which he answered triumphantly. Finally, the judge invited each of them to recite the best passage from their poems. Hesiod recited the beginning of his agricultural precepts, Works and Days, when the Pylades was born of Atlas, all in due season. Homer recited a splendid description of Greek warriors drawn up in close formation to face the foe from the Iliad. The crowd acclaimed Homer, but the judge awarded the prize to Hesiod on the grounds that the poet, who commended husbandry and the works of peace, was to be preferred to the one who told of battle and slaughter. The crowd's preference was that of the ancient world in general, and rightly so. But Alcadamas, championing of Hesiod, foreshadows his popularity in the Alexandrian age, when more than one intellectual poet, a little bored perhaps, with the martial epic he had drummed into him at school, showed enthusiasm for the didactic poet, or in some cases took him as a mascot. Not that any of them produced anything at all like Hesiod. The didactic poetry of this period consisted of systematic expositions of technical subjects, whether agriculture, beekeeping, astronomy, or some medical topic, without the wide-ranging variety, the moralizing, or the personal framework that characterized the works and days. But they looked back to Hesiod as the founder of the genre and emulated his compactness of style. Virgil's Georgics really belong in this Alexandrian tradition and owe more to the Alexandrian didactic poets than to Hesiod. Yet, it is as the Roman Hesiod that Virgil advertises himself. And I sing Ascra's song through Roman towns. There can be few clearer affirmations of Hesiod's classic status.
Theogony.
From the muses of Helicon, let us begin our singing, that haunt Helicon's great and holy mountain, and dance on their soft feet round the violent dark spring, and the altar of the mighty son of Cronos, and when they have bathed their gentle skin in Permesos, or the horse's fountain, or the holy Omeos, then on the highest slope of the Helicon, they make their dances, fair and lovely, stepping lively in time. From there they go forth, veiled in thick mist, and walk by night, uttering beautiful voice, singing of Zeus, who bears the Aegis. And the lady of Hera of Argos, who walks in sandals of gold, and the daughter of Zeus, the Aegis-bearer, pale-eyed Athene, and Phobos, Apollo, and Artemis the archer, and Poseidon, earth-charioted, shaker of the earth, and holy Themis, and Aphrodite of curling lashes, and Hebe of gold diadem, and fair Dione, Leto, Iapetos, and crooked schemer Cronos, dawn mighty sun and shining moon, earth, great Oceanus, and dark night, and the rest of the holy family of immortals who are forever. And once they taught Hesiod fine singing, as he tended his lambs below the holy Helicon, this is what the goddesses said to me first, the Olympian muse, daughter of Zeus, the Aegis-bearer. Shepherds that camp in the wild, disgraces, merest bellies, we know to tell many lies that sound like truth, but we know to sing reality when we will. So said mighty Zeus's daughters, the sure of utterance, and they gave me a branch of springingly bay to pluck for a staff, a handsome one, and they breathed into me the wondrous voice, so that I should celebrate things of the future and things that were after time. And they told me to sing of the family of blessed ones who are forever, and first and last, always to sing of themselves. But what is my business round tree or rock? Come now, from the muses let us begin, who with their singing delight the great mind of Zeus, the father in Olympus, as they tell of what is and what shall be and what was aforetime, voices in unison. The words flow untiring from their mouths and sweet, and the halls of their father, loud thundering Zeus, rejoice at the goddesses. Clear voice spread abroad, and the peak of the snowy Olympus rings, and the mansions of the gods, making divine utterance. They celebrate first in their song the august family of gods, from the beginning, whose whom earth and broad heaven begot, and the gods that were born from them, givers of blessings. Second, they sing of Zeus, father of gods and men, how far the highest of the god he is, and the greatest in power. And again they sing of the family of men and of powerful giants, to delight the mind of Zeus and Olympus, those Olympian muses, daughters of Zeus, the Aegis-bearer. They were born in Pyrrha, to Memory, queen of the foothills of Ilithera, in union with the father, the son of Cronos, oblivion of ills and respite from cares. 9 nights Zeus the resourceful lay with her, going up to her holy bed far away from the immortals. And when the time came, as the months passed away and the seasons turned about, and the long tale of days was completed, she bore 9 daughters, all of one mind, their carefree hearts set on song. not far from the topmost peak of snowy Olympus. There they have their gleaming, dancing places and their fair mansions, and the graces and desire dwell beside them in feasting. Lovely is the sound they produce from their mouths as they sing and celebrate the ordinances and the good ways of all the immortals, making delightful utterance. So then they went to Olympus, glorying in their beautiful voices, singing divinely. The dark earth rang round them as they sang, and from their dancing feet came a lovely estampai as they went to their father. He is king in heaven. He is the thunder and the smoking bolt. Since he defeated his father Cronos by strength, he has appointed their ordinances to the immortals, well in each detail, and assigned them their privileges. This is what the Muses sang, who dwell in Olympus, the nine daughters born of great Zeus. Clio and Euterpe and Thalia and Melpomene, Terpeshora and Erato, Polyhymnia and Urania, and Calliope, who is chief among them all. For she even attends august kings. Whomsoever great Zeus's daughters favor among the kings that Zeus fosters, and turn their eyes upon him at his birth, upon his tongue they shed sweet dew, and out of his mouth the words flow honeyed, and the peoples all look to him as he decides what is to prevail with his straight judgments. His word is sure, and expertly he makes a quick end of even a great dispute. This is why there are prudent kings. When the peoples are wronged in their dealings, they make amends for them with ease, persuading them with gentle words. When he goes among a gathering, they seek his favor with conciliatory reverence, as if he were a god, and he stands out among the crowd. Such is the Muses' holy gift to men. For well it is from the Muses, a far-shooting Apollo, that men are singers and citharists on earth, and from Zeus, that they are kings. Every man is fortunate whom the Muses love. The voice flows sweet from his lips. Though a man's heart be withered with the grief of a recent bereavement, if then a singer, the servant of the Muses, sings of the famous deeds of men of old, and of the blessed gods who dwell in Olympus, he soon forgets his sorrows and thinks no more of his family troubles, quickly diverted by the goddess's gifts. Farewell now, children of Zeus, and grant me delightful singing. Celebrate the holy family of immortals, whose are forever, those who were born of earth and heaven and of black night, and those whom the briny sea fostered. And tell how the gods of the earth were born in the first place, and the rivers, and the boundless sea with its furious swell, and the shining stars and broad firmament above, and how they shared out their estate, and how they divided their privileges, and how they gained all the glens of Olympus in the first place. Tell me this from the beginning, Muses, who dwell in Olympus, and say, what thing among them came first? First came the chasm, and then broad-breasted earth. Secure seat forever of all the immortals who occupy the peak of snowy Olympus, the misty Tartara, in a remote recess of the broad-pathed earth and Eros, the most handsome among the immortal gods, dissolver of flesh, who overcomes the reason and purpose in the breasts of all gods and all men. Out of the chasm came Erebos and dark night, and from night in turn came bright air and day, whom she bore and shared intimacy with Erebos. Earth bore first of all one equal to herself, starry heaven, so that he should cover her all about, to be a secure seat forever for the blessed gods. And she bore the long mountains, pleasant haunts of the goddesses, the nymphs who dwell in the mountain glens. And she also bore the undraining sea and its furious swell, not in union of love, but then bedded with heaven, she bore deep, swirling Oceanus. Koios and Krios and Hyperion and Iapetos, Thea and Rhea and Themis and Memory, Phoebe of gold diadem and lovely Tethys. After them, the youngest was born, crooked schemer Kronos, most fearsome of children, who loathed his lusty father. And then again she bore the proud-hearted Cyclopes, Thunderer, Lightner, and White Bolt of stern spirit, who gave Zeus his thunder and forged his thunderbolt. In other respects, they were like the gods, but a single eye lay in the middle of their forehead. They had the surname of Circle Eyes because of this one circular eye that lay on their forehead, and strength and force and resource were upon their works. And again, there were born of earth and heaven three more sons, mighty and stern, not to be spoken of, Kodos, Bereros, and Gyges, overbearing children. 100 arms sprang from their shoulders, unshapen hulks, and 50 heads grew from the shoulders of each of them upon their stalwart bodies, and strength boundless and powerful was upon their mighty form. For all those that were born of earth and heaven were the most fearsome of children, and their own father loathed them from the beginning. As soon as each of them was born, he hid them away in a cavern of earth, and would not let them into the light, and he took pleasure in the wicked work, did heaven, while the huge earth was tight-pressed inside and groaned. She thought up a nasty trick. Without delay, she created the element of great adamant, and made a great reaping hook, and showed it to her dear children, and spoke to them courage, sore at heart as she was. Children of mine, and of an evil father, I wonder whether you would like to do as I say. We could get redress from your father's cruelty, after all. He began it by his ugly behavior. So she spoke, but they were all seized by fear, and none of them uttered a word. But the great crooked schemer Kronos took courage, and soon replied to his good mother. Mother, I would undertake this task and accomplish it. I am not afraid of our unspeakable father. After all, he began it by his ugly behavior. So he spoke, and mighty earth was delighted. She set him hidden in ambush, put the sharp-toothed sickle into his hand, and explained the whole stratagem to him. Great heaven came, bringing on the night, and desirous of love, he spread himself over earth, stretched out in every direction. His son reached out from the ambush with his left hand. With his right, he took the huge sickle with its long row of sharp teeth and quickly cut off his father's genitals and flung them behind him to fly where they might. They were not released from his hand to no effect, for all the drops of blood that flew off were received by Earth, and as the years went round, she bore the powerful Erinyes and the great giants in gleaming armor with long spears in their hands, and the nymphs, who they call Malele, on the boundless earth. As for the genitals, just as he first cut them off with his instrument of adamant and threw them from the land into the surging sea, even so they were carried on the waves for a long time. About them a white foam grew from the immortal flesh, and in it a girl formed. First she approached holy Cythera. Then, from there, she came to the sea-girt Cyprus, and out stepped a modest and beautiful goddess. And the grass began to grow all around beneath her slender feet. Gods and men call her Aphrodite, because she was formed in foam, and Cythera because she approached Cythera, and Cyprus born because she was born in wave-washed Cyprus, and genial because she appeared out of the genitals. Eros and fair desire attended her birth and accompanied her as she went to join the family of gods. And this has been her allotted province from the beginning, among men and immortal gods. The whisperings of girls, smiles, deceptions, sweet pleasure, intimacy, and tenderness. As for those children of great heaven, their father who begot them, railed at them and gave them the surname of Titan, saying that straining tight in wickedness they had done a serious thing, and that he had a title to revenge for it later. Night bore hateful doom and dark fate and death. She bore sleep. She bore the tribe of dreams. And secondly, gloomy night bore cavil and painful misery, bedded with none of the gods and the Hesperides, who mined fair golden apples,
beyond the famed Oceanus, and the trees that bear that fruit, and the fates she bore, and the mercilessly punishing furies who prosecute the transgressions of men and gods. Never do the goddesses cease from their terrible wrath until they have paid the sinner his due, and baleful night gave birth to resentment, also an affliction for mortal men. And after her she bore deceit and intimacy, and a cursed old age, and she bore hard-hearted strife.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.